Let me ask you something before we go anywhere today. How much fuel do you actually need to land with? Not how much you'd like to land with. Not what feels comfortable. What does the regulation say is the legal minimum? And more important, what number keeps you off the evening news during the busiest week in aviation? This is Radio Hangar. I'm Pattern, and this is Traffic Pattern, the show where we try to make you a sharper, safer pilot one topic at a time. And this week, with 250,000 people and more airplanes than you can count all pointed at one little field in Wisconsin, we need to talk about fuel. Specifically, we need to talk about a regulation with a boring name and enormous consequences. Federal Aviation Regulation 9151 Fuel Requirements for Flight in Visual Conditions. Stick with me, because if there is one week of the year where this rule earns its keep, it is right now on the cross-country to EAA Air Venture Oshkosh. Before we dig in, a quick shout out to our friends at AviationSoul.com. They make challenge coins for every step of the journey. Got your first solo? There's a coin for that. Private pilot, instrument, commercial. They've got you covered. It's a great way to mark the milestones that matter. And honestly, planning your first long cross country to a big fly-in is one of those milestones. So mark it. AviationSoul.com. Okay, let's walk through this together. Here's what 91151 actually says in plain English. For a flight in daytime visual conditions, you may not take off in an airplane unless you have enough fuel to fly to your first point of intended landing, and then, assuming normal cruising speed, to fly after that for at least 30 minutes. At night, that number goes up. Enough fuel to reach your destination, plus 45 minutes. That's it. Day, 30 minutes of reserve. Night, 45 minutes of reserve. Both figured at normal cruise, not at some optimistic lean of peak, pulled back, best case number. Now, here's the first thing I want you to really hear. That is a legal minimum. It is not a plan.
The regulation tells you the floor. The floor is the point where, if you go below it, you have broken a rule. But nobody flies to the floor. Nobody smart, anyway. The floor is not where you build your fuel plan. The floor is the thing you never want to see. Because seeing it means five different decisions upstream already went sideways. Let me say that a different way. Because it matters. 30 minutes of reserve is what's left over after everything went according to plan. And when does everything go according to plan? This week? Almost never. Let me paint you the real scenario. This is the one that actually happens. You're flying into Oshkosh during Air Venture. You did your homework. You read the NOTAM, all 30-some pages of it. You know the FISC arrival? You've got ripping in your flight plan. You're gonna follow the railroad tracks. You're ready to rock your wings when the controller calls your airplane. You feel good. You planned your fuel to the airport. Let's say the flight is 2.5 hours. Your airplane burns, call it, 10 gallons an hour. So 2.5 hours is 25 gallons to get there, plus a 30-minute reserve. That's another 5 gallons, 30 gallons total, and your tanks hold 40. You're thinking, I've got plenty. 10 gallons of margin on top of the reserve, and then you arrive, and so does everybody else. The arrival is packed. The controllers are working airplanes like a symphony conductor, but there's a conga line stacked up from Ripon, and you get told to go around the lake and try again. Now you're flying a big racetrack, burning fuel, not making progress toward landing. That's 20 minutes gone. Then the field goes to a temporary hold because there's an airplane disabled on the runway. Happens. Now everybody's circling. Another 15 minutes? Then you finally get sequenced. You're on short final to your assigned color dot, and tower sends you around a balked landing. Somebody didn't clear the runway in time, and the controller is not going to squeeze you in on top of them. Good call by the controller, but that's you, full power, climbing out, going back around the lake one more time. Add it up. That's the better part of an hour you did not plan for. That comfortable 10-gallon cushion? Gone. And now you're eating into the reserve you swore you'd never touch. Now the panic starts to creep in. And a panicked pilot in the busiest airspace in the world is exactly what nobody needs. That is how a legal, technically compliant fuel plan turns into an emergency. Not because you broke the rule at takeoff, because you planned to the minimum and the day refused to cooperate. So here's something I wish someone told me when I was training. Reserve fuel is not the fuel you use. It's the fuel that means you already made a mistake if you're using it. Your real planning number should never be 30 minutes. For a trip like this into an event like this, I want you thinking in hours. I want an hour of usable fuel in the tanks when you cross the fence. Minimum, and honestly, more if the airplane and the mission allow it. Because the whole point of a reserve is that it's untouched. It's the money in the account you don't spend. Let's talk about how you build a real fuel plan, step by step. Because this is the part the check ride tests and the part real life tests even harder. Start with your known burn, not the number in the pilot's operating handbook from when the airplane was new. Your number. The one you've actually seen at the pump, corrected for how you actually fly. If you don't know your real fuel burn yet, that's your homework this week, and it's more valuable than any avionics upgrade you could buy. Then figure the fuel to your destination at that burn, at a realistic cruise, with a realistic climb. Climb burns more, account for it. Now add wind. A headwind doesn't just make you late, it makes you thirsty, because you're burning the same gallons per hour but covering less ground. So the trip takes longer and the total fuel goes up. Check the winds aloft. This week especially, the afternoon can build up over Wisconsin, and weather means delays, and delays mean fuel. Then, and this is the step people skip, plan your alternate. Where do you go if Oshkosh says no? During AirVenture, this is not optional thinking. Fond du Lac is right there to the south, running its own arrival procedures for the overflow. There are other fields around. Know them before you leave home, know how much fuel it takes to get from the Oshkosh hold to your alternate land, and still have a reserve when you shut down. That number, destination plus diversion plus reserve, that's the fuel you actually need, not the airport direct number. Then add your personal reserve on top of all of it. The regulation says 30 minutes day. Your personal minimum should be higher. Pick a number, write it down. Mine, for a trip like this, is 1 hour on the ground, meaning I have decided in advance that if I'm going to land with less than an hour in the tanks, I'm not continuing to Oshkosh, I'm diverting to get gas. That decision is made at the kitchen table, not at 2,000 feet over Ripon with my heart pounding. Now, let's connect this to two more regulations, because they travel together and the examiner likes to see that you understand the family, not just the one rule. The first is 91.103, pre-flight action. It says before you begin a flight, you must become familiar with all available information concerning that flight. For a cross-country, that specifically includes fuel requirements and alternatives available if the planned flight cannot be completed. Read that again. The regulation itself, the one about pre-flight planning, explicitly names your fuel and your alternatives as required knowledge. The FAA is practically writing the Oshkosh diversion plan for you. All you have to do is actually do it. The second is 91.3, the responsibility and authority of the pilot in command. That's the one that says you and you alone are directly responsible for the operation of that aircraft, and you are the final authority. Fuel is where that authority gets real. Nobody is going to make the divert call for you. The controller is managing traffic, not your tanks. The friend you told you'd meet at the North 40 is not in the cockpit. When the fuel gets tight, it is your airplane, your call, your certificate, and your life. 91.3 gives you the authority. It also hands you the whole weight of it.
So how does an examiner test this? Because it's on the airman certification standards, and it comes up in ways students don't always expect. On the ground during the cross-country planning portion, the examiner is looking for you to show a real fuel plan, not just a total, but the reasoning. They want to see you account for taxi, run-up, climb, cruise, and a reserve, and they want to hear you say what your personal minimums are. If you just point at 30 minutes and say, "That's the reg," you've technically answered and completely missed the point, and a good examiner will push you on it, then they'll give you a scenario. It'll sound a lot like the one I described. Headwinds stronger than forecast. You're behind your fuel plan. Your destination is socked in or backed up. What do you do? The examiner is looking for a pilot who recognizes the trend early, who has a divert field already in mind, and who makes the decision to get fuel before it becomes an emergency. They are looking for the pilot who treats the reserve as sacred. And here's the thing. That's not a check ride skill. That's a life skill that the check ride happens to test. Fuel exhaustion, running the tanks dry, and fuel starvation, having fuel but not getting it to the engine. Together, those are among the most preventable accident causes in all of general aviation. Preventable, every single one is a chain of small decisions, and almost every chain has an early link where somebody could have just landed and bought gas and turned a scary story into a boring one. Be the boring story. I cannot say that enough. In aviation, boring is the goal. Boring means everybody went home. Let me give you the practical takeaways you can use, not just this week, but on your next flight, whatever it is. Know your real fuel burn in gallons per hour at the power settings you actually use. If you don't know it, go find out. Plan to a reserve you set for yourself and make it bigger than the legal minimum. An hour of fuel on the ground for a big event is a good place to start. Pick your divert field before you take off and know the fuel it takes to get there from your destination. During AirVenture, that means knowing your overflow options cold. Watch the trend in flight, not just the gauges in the moment. If you're falling behind your fuel plan, that is information. Act on it early, while you still have options in altitude and daylight and a calm head. And make the divert decision at the kitchen table. Decide, before you ever start the engine, the number that means you stop and get gas, then honor it, even when Oshkosh is only 20 minutes away and everything in you wants to press on. Especially then, because here's the truth about this week. Getting to AirVenture is not the accomplishment. Anybody can point an airplane at Wisconsin. The accomplishment is arriving with fuel in the tanks and options in your pocket, having flown the whole thing like a professional, even if you're a student pilot on your longest cross-country ever. That's what being a good pilot looks like. It's not the greaser landing on the colored dot, though that's fun. It's the quiet, unglamorous discipline of the fuel plan that never let the situation get exciting. The information on the regulations today comes straight from the Federal Aviation Regulations themselves, parts 9151, 103, and .3, and the reasoning around personal minimums lines up with what the FAA teaches in its own safety materials. You can read all of it yourself, and I'd encourage you to. And you can find more from us over at RadioHangar.com. So this week, when you're figuring your trip to Oshkosh, add a little more fuel than you think you need. Then decide, right now, at the table, the number you won't go below. Fly safe out there. I'll see you in the pattern.